Oh, thank you, Chair. I haven't got anything very profound to add to what Adam has outlined, but I would just recommend to any members or other interested people a fabulous little book that was written by Karl Marx called Value, Price and Profit. I always refer back to it actually because it speaks in very plain language. It's not like reading Capital volumes 1 to 3, etc. It's written as a critique of others who are at the time making assertions about where wealth, value, prices, wages, etc., etc., are determined. And there's just one sentence in it really that just sums it all up. And Adam's already iterated this, but it's just that Marx said, and I've always remembered the quote, I've just written it down just so I'm sure I've got it right. But the value of a commodity is determined by the total quantity of labour contained in it. Which for me is very profound because it sort of explains that, you know, that there may be historical factors even that are there, but also that one of the other sort of areas that Marx touches on in a very readable way is in the short chapter 5, which is about wages and prices. It's sort of a, you know, I'd need to reread it really to be able to explain it very well. But there was a sort of an argument during Marx's lifetime that if wages increase, then prices go down, or if wages go down, then prices go down, which he really disabused. So I'm sure Adam is much more learned on this than myself, but I just thought that I'll just pass
All right,
that
thanks,
on.
Andy. Thanks, Andy. Have you finished? Yeah, okay, thank you. I'll check for it then, and then get Adam to come back in. Thank you.
Yeah,
Right, find another good.
thanks, Steve. I'll hold my hands up and admit that I'm to some extent one of those individuals that have some difficulty in understanding exactly what Marx was writing on occasions on this labour theory of value. And perhaps it's the language used. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that Marx is wrong. All right, when it comes to that, I suppose to some extent, is because it's the language that certainly in the pamphlet, and I've tried reading it on a number of occasions, and most of it I can come to grips with. But I'll give you an example of where I'm not coming to grips with it on, and it's on page 9 of the some aspects of Marxian economics. I could bring other examples, but because it's particularly tonight or at this time on the labour theory of value, and I'll read this, right? It says, "The value of a commodity," said Marx, "is determined by the amount of socially necessary labour contained in it, or what is the same thing, by the amount of socially necessary labour time spent in producing it from start to finish." That I understand. Note that the labor theory of value does not say that the value of a commodity is determined by the actual amount of labor contained in it. And then it goes on to say that would mean that an inefficient worker would create more value than an efficient worker. And it goes on a little bit. Now, I don't readily understand that. I'm holding my hand up and say, I don't readily understand that would mean that an inefficient worker would create more value than an efficient worker.
I just right. Can we let Adam answer that then?
Right.
It's a real, I'm glad you brought that up because it's a really clear problem. Adam.
Yeah. Well, it's what is meant by socially necessary. I mean, if in fact the value of a commodity was determined by the amount of actual labour that was embodied in it or labour time spent on producing it, it would mean that the slow worker would produce more value than the average worker or the because they would be spending more time making it. So I think that's the point that's getting on. Whenever you say that the value of a commodity is fixed by the amount of labour incorporated from start to finish, you have to say the amount of, well, in this case, Marx said socially necessary labour. But I mean, I said in my talk, the work by a standard worker working under standard conditions, or if you like, an average worker working under average conditions, that you have to add socially necessary or required, because if, as I say, I think it's a fairly obvious concept actually that it can't be the case that it's always actual labour. It has to be this notional average or socially necessary labour that. As I say, I mean, I don't, I'm sure you can understand that phrase. I think it's quite a basic, simple point. But I mean, value, price, and profit is probably the best introduction to it, because what it was Marx giving a talk in English to a meeting of. Well, I could say they were leading English trade unions. You can imagine the situation of all sitting around there, Marx speaking with a German accent. But what he was arguing against in particular was the view which was held by some followers of Robert Owen that a rise in wages would lead to a rise in prices. Therefore, it wasn't worth asking for a rise. In wages, and Marx goes into the various reasons why this isn't the case. Now, in value, price, and profit, he is assuming that all commodities sell or exchange at their labour time value. But this isn't affected by the fact that, as he said in Volume 3 of Capital, most commodities don't exchange at their labour time value; they exchange at their price of production. But it's still the case that an increase in wages won't lead to an increase in prices. But once again, the reason for this is obviously nothing to do with the labour theory of value, because it must be assumed that the employer or the manufacturer or the business is already selling its products, its commodity, at the price it can get, the best price it can get, at what the market will bear. The fact that there's an increase in wages doesn't alter that fact. But there is one circumstance in which it would do well, and that is, which I assume is probably the position of most of us here. If you're working for a government or a semi-government organisation, a civil service or teaching or universities or something, you're not producing any value at all. So if there's an increase in wages there, then it can only be paid for out of the government, raising the money from taxes and so on. I mean, obviously Marx wasn't dealing with that in his day. To come back to the point that Steve mentioned at the at the beginning, it's another reason why the value of a commodity isn't the same as the amount of actual labour that is incorporated. I mean, even if we assume that the amount of labour incorporated in it has been socially necessary, you know, the value of the thing can still go down if subsequently there's some new invention or some new procedure for organizing production. If that happens and becomes widespread, that affects the value of all the commodities previously produced that haven't been sold. So I think it's you have to be very careful not to say or not to give the impression that the value of a commodity is dependent on the actual amount of labour taken to produce it from start to finish.
Now, listen, and nobody else has got their hand up, so through you, Chair, can I come back on that, please?
Yeah, go on.
Sorry?
Yeah, go on.
You know, I take on board what Adam's saying there, or substantially take on board what Adam is saying there. Okay, I mean, I understand that maybe somebody working in an office, etc. I know that. What I'm not grasping, for whatever reason I'm not grasping it, is what it says here, that about the note that the labour theory of value does not say that the value of a commodity is determined by the actual amount of labour contained in it. It says then that would mean an inefficient worker would create more value than an efficient worker. I can't see how an inefficient worker can create more value than an efficient one. In other words, if I was producing a cartwheel and I could turn one out, right, because I'm inefficient, but another carpenter turns out two cartwheels, then how's the value determined from that then? How can an inefficient worker, or an alleged inefficient worker, determine the price then when somebody who's making two is a greater degree of exploitation? I understand that. So that's about I'm not readily understanding.
But I think you have understood it perfectly. You're using the same argument as you've quoted. It's saying it's a mistake to say that the labour theory value says that the value of a commodity is the actual labour embodied in it. And then it goes on to say, if this was the case, it would then mean that a slow worker would produce more value than the average worker. But I mean, it's if this is the case, and it's saying it isn't the case. I mean, so that proves that, you know, that proves the point. I mean, I think you've understood it perfectly. I mean, it's obvious when you think about it, but it can't be the case that the actual labour of somebody or the time it took somebody will contribute to it. It must be some sort of average. Otherwise, say, you know, the slow worker would be producing more value than the average worker. And it would be in the interests of employers to employ as many slow workers as possible. I mean, that's what those three things together are refuting. What Africa is saying, I think you have understood it.
I'll have a chat with Steve tomorrow or Paul Bennett when I'm at Wigan.
I was just going to say that, Freddie. I think you just misread it. Okay, Andrew.
Well, I've got some sympathy with people who have, difficulty getting your head around it, because I did when I was a lot younger. And what I used to think, I'll be really honest about this, I used to think when I read Capital the first time, was that Marx was basically saying, you know, if you go to work and you put in a shift, and let's say you earn a fiver, well, the capitalist is taking a tenner. That's very simplistic, okay? They're taking that from you, okay? And then they'll sell whatever you've created that day, whatever it might be, and they'll sell it for a bit more than the fiver, you know, so they might get £12. So that was how I originally understood the labour theory of value. I was a bit off the mark, I think, I realise now, but probably not hugely, hugely, hugely. I was heading in the right direction. But I do understand that people will kind of find it hard to grasp, and I'm still trying to grasp it all myself. How this totality of labour, this totality of socially necessary labour, kind of coheres into what ultimately becomes a price on the open market. But just coming back a little bit as well on Adam, a gentle little nudge with something Adam said about. Obviously, a lot of us in Western societies now work in service economies, as well as people working in technology and communications and other things like that, which I suppose are sort of probably service industries anyway. But certainly teachers, for one thing, I'm not a teacher, and health workers. This idea that people like that don't create value. I think if we really look at it in the totality of socially necessary labour, there's an argument within that sort of whole equation. Teachers are preparing workers for profit making for the capitalist class. Health workers are patching the workers up to maintain them as fodder for profit. There's that sort of side of it. I was just sort of random stuff that I just scribbled down actually as well. It is just coming back to my first point about this idea that if you put in a shift, you get ripped off sort of 60% of the work you do. That's not really taken into account necessarily, depending on what commodity you're working on. But let's just say you're making bricks. You've got to think about maybe the canals, the quarries, the builders, the transport, all that side of it before it always gets to the actual brick making kind of facility. So just thought I would mention
that. Thanks, Andrew. That's an interesting. Interesting observation. Adam, I think I'd better let you take that first before I take Richard.
Well, I was going to do with something else that you said, but I think you made two different points.
Yeah.
But the reason that I started off by explaining what might be called the labour theory of wealth, you don't need, in fact, the labour theory of value to see that workers are economically exploited. There's only one way in which wealth can be produced, and that is by human beings applying their mental and physical energies to transform and change things that originally came from nature. So that means that any non-work income, any non-work property income, has to come out of the what the people actually doing this transformation of the race of nature produce. I mean, you don't really need a labour theory of value to explain that workers are exploited. But the second point becomes more complicated because Marx does draw a distinction between productive labour and non-productive labour. But when he says productive, it's productive of value, and those that are not producing labour. I mean, productive workers aren't just confined to manual workers. Any worker that has something to do with the actual production of something, the actual, say, transforming things that came from nature, which will include, designers or organizers and so on. Non-productive workers, an example would be servants, which are paid out of the income of capitalists, but there's a reason why civil servants are called civil servants. They're servants of the capitalist state, and they're paid out of income of capitalists, which has been taxed away by the state. But say that doesn't mean that somebody working in education or somebody working in the health service aren't exploited. They're still paid less than the time they give. It just isn't expressed in monetary terms. But I think you've got a good point there as well, Andy, that in fact these people are necessary to the people in education and health service. They are necessary for the functioning of the capitalist system. They it's a sort of, what can you say, socialization of the costs of producing labor party, which is shared amongst all the capitalist class. But I mean, I say this is a complicated thing, because Marx himself complained of two different definitions of unproductive labor. I mean, you know, at one point he says that a teacher in a private school is producing, you know, value for their employer, which Peter Lawrence used to refute this argument or comment on this argument. He says that if you're a worker working in any municipal golf course, you're not exploited. If you're working in a private golf course, you are, which doesn't make sense. His argument was, the conclusion he said, that we should say that all work is productive, and it is in one sense, but not in the sense of producing value. Okay, that's the answer to the two points.
Okay, thank you. Before Pat comes in, if I could just say something. That's abusing the chair. Go ahead, Pat. My apologies.
Thank you.
Go ahead, comrade. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry about that. There's some of these points actually just made by Adam, but what I wanted to speak about was many, many years ago, I attended a series of education classes that were run by comrades Hardy, Darcy, and McClatchy. Conway Hall. In the hardest talk, I got my theories.
Comrade, we can't hear you very well. Can you sit closer to your PC, to your laptop, please? We find it very difficult to understand what you're saying.
Right. How's this?
Very quiet again.
How's this?
That's fine.
Yes, I've now got this. The headset on. I don't know how much you heard, but I said about attending a series of education classes run by comrades Hardy, Darcy, and McClatchy. And during, comrade Hardy dealt with the economics. And it was from that talk that I got my clearest understanding of the concept of value. And how it is, and that was that value is a social concept, which covers the point of it's the whole of the working class that is exploited by the capitalist class. And although, as Adam has covered the point, obviously, about the workers who actually produce things that are products that can actually be sold, but the other workers are all necessary to the running of capitalism, and that includes the people that have been mentioned, you know, the teachers and everyone else, but they're all necessary to the system, and that's what gave me my clearest sort of understanding of the economics of capitalism. Not an expert by any means, but that was what gave me my best insight of the understanding of value as a social concept. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Pat. Right, can I? Okay, so Andrew wants to speak. Go ahead, comrade.
Thanks. I don't want to say very much. It's just a follow-on from what Pat said. Edgar Hardcastle's talks on economics are available on YouTube.
Yeah, and in fact, his there is a big archive on Marxist.org of his articles. Okay, thanks then, Andrew. Just make a comment. Adam, I think you said in your talk that Marx in Volume 1 of Capital, Marx took the argument that, or rather put forward the idea that commodities sold at the value. Isn't it the case that he was just making that assumption for the sake of argument so that he could look at the issue of value in its most basic sense, excluding competition? That's my understanding of it, because other people may not be aware of the fact that he was attacked in the 80s. Well, Volume 3 was attacked in the 1890s as a contradiction, because at once in Volume 1 he's talking about commodities exchanging at value, and this they claim was inconsistent with what he was talking about in the Volume 3. That's quite plainly not the case, but it is still but that attack is still being used today on Marx's arguments. So, but you did actually say that he treats them as exchanging at value, but I think my interpretation is he used that as a part of his argument to isolate the principle of value.
No, I think that's right. I think it's more accurate to say that he assumes in Volume 1 of Capital that commodities exchange at the value. I was just summarizing the argument of the people that say it's a contradiction. And he said, they say Marx in Volume 1, he says they exchange at their values. In Volume 3, he says that they don't. That they exchange at the cost price plus the market for profit, and they see this as a contradiction. But of course, I think there's a footnote somewhere in Volume 1 of Capital which actually says, later on I'll explain this isn't the case. But in any event, you can't explain prices of production without having understanding of what value would be. I think you're entirely right. It's an assumption that it's part of the development of an argument. I mean, he starts off Capital by he doesn't even assume that the people are working for wages. He just assumes that there are independent artisans and shopkeepers and farmers and so on who own their own means of production, who are producing stuff to be to be exchanged. So he starts there, and then he introduces people working for wages, the separation of the producer from the means of production, and it comes to Capital. So that's the way he argues. But I wouldn't say that the first few chapters of Capital are easy going, because he talks about relative value and equal value and so on. I know we say people should start by reading Marx, but I think the simplest thing, as Andy pointed out, is the value, price, and profit. Though even there, he uses rate of profit to mean what elsewhere he calls rate of surplus value. But as long as you take these things into account, you can get a basic grasp of the point he's trying to make. I think the first part of first chapter of Volume 1 is quite good, because he's defining what use value is, he's defining what labor is, he's defining what commodity is. But after that, when he gets into exchange, it becomes a bit complicated. But incidentally, I don't think it's a badge of honor to be a productive worker being exploited for surplus value, and a shame to be a non-productive worker who isn't exploited. I mean, as Pat said, most of the non-productive workers are, in fact, part of the cost to the capitalist class of running the system. They obviously have to have a civil service, they have to have education, have to have a health service, and so on. I wouldn't quite say that all non-productive workers are useful to capitalism. Obviously, the capitalists' servants aren't, and but I mean that's a small section of, although today it's a small section of society. But I think there are quite a few. I think it's been a revival of domestic servants in recent years. But I think somewhere in Volume 1 of Capital, he points out that there are more in the 1860-61 census, there were more domestic servants than there were people working in engineering. But I mean, that's changed.
But if I remember right, he mentioned that point to prove how much they'd made out of the working class in the 1820s to 1850s, wasn't it? Right. Okay. Well, there's nobody got any hands up at the moment. Could I just ask you, Adam, to expound a little bit on the idea of exploitation to give it its Marxian meaning, because there's so many people that got this idea that exploitation is some sort of moral argument, which of course it isn't. It is slightly off the track, but I think it's been mentioned already tonight.
No, as I said, the labour theory of wealth shows that any non-work property income must derive from the work of those who actually do produce wealth. But I mean that's very general and applies to other societies besides capitalism. I think the key distinction, which incidentally Marx himself didn't make until the 1850s, is between what's called labour power and labour. And he showed that labour power, which is the mental and physical energies of the worker, that's what the worker sells. But of course, the capitalist buys that. But he has it. Well, he or she or they have the use of the worker's labour power during a period of time, and. I think Annie was saying this at the beginning. I mean, the examples are fairly simple. If it takes 5 hours for the worker to create the value of his or her labour power, any time beyond that is producing surplus labour and surplus value, for the employer. And so that is the exploitation. The worker produces more than the value of what they're paid. I mean, there's nothing immoral about this. Nobody's been cheated. Everybody has been given. Everybody has had the exchange value of what they have to sell. Workers are exploited. A level of their wages. I mean, today the word exploitation is used for instance, by trade union militants and so on, to mean somebody who's paid less than the value of their labour power. I mean, that exists, but that isn't Marx's criticism or his theory of exploitation. And to come back to the thing I mentioned, the rate of exploitation is the proportion of profits to wages, while the rate of profit is the ratio of profits to total capital. But say, I mean, it's a question of of languages as to what you call them. But say, in value, price, and profit, he calls the ratio of wages to profits the rate of profit. But it puts his point to the people he was talking to, these British trade unionists, that workers are exploited.
Okay. Andy, I'm going to take Richard first because he's not spoken yet. It's okay. I'd love to be.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? I'm having problems with my system at the moment.
Yeah.
Is it good? Thank you. I just wanted to add a little bit to what Adam has just said about exploitation. You get a lot of, to repeat initially what he said, you get a lot of left wingers who think that exploitation means that the worker should be getting the full value of their labor, because they're only thinking about the situation within capitalism. But that's not what Marx is saying at all. Marx is not supposing that the worker should get the full value of his labor within capitalism, because in any society, the worker is not going to get the full value of his labor back for himself, because a certain percentage of his labor has to go on producing machinery, etc., for the next round of production. My reading of Marx is that he's not simply talking about exploitation as a purely economic process, but he's also talking about exploitation as a process of what you might call political power, the ability to make decisions. So the part of the exploitation that the worker is experiencing under capitalism is not just that he's having this value taken away from him by the capitalist, some of which he's using for himself, some of which he's actually returning as capital, but he's also in a situation where he has no choice. He has no right of decision over how his labor is going to be used for social purposes. So it's about exploitation has two aspects to it. It's an economic exploitation, but I think even more than that, it's a political exploitation, in that the worker is denied any kind of say in how his labor is actually going to be used. So he's actually working under the direction of somebody else, and he's completely disenfranchised politically in that sense. So just wanted to throw that in.
Okay. Do you want to come back and tell that, Adam?
Yes, I mean, I entirely agree that in any society, the people that produce the wealth can produce more than enough to maintain the populations. But so there is a social surplus. But it's a question of who owns or who controls this social surplus. In ancient slave society, it's the slave owners. In feudalism, it's the feudal barons. And in capitalism, it's the capitalist owners of the means of production. In a socialist system of society, that social surplus will belong in common to the whole of society to be decided by society how it should be used. So, as I say, I entirely agree. Exploitation is more than the fact that workers are capable of producing more than more than the wealth that has to be used up to maintain, and that will be the situation even in socialism. It's about who owns, or who controls, or who decides how this surplus is used.
Okay, thanks. Right, Andrew, over you go.
Yeah, just a quick point, really. I think Richard and Adam have just covered most of what I was going to say anyway, really, about exploitation. I think, like, from a contextual point of view, it's very important to remember Marx was a revolutionary figure. He wasn't, a fusty academic. He wanted to make a social revolution, a political revolution, a communist revolution. So he was a man of action. And so I think when he was talking about exploitation, it's important to remember it in terms of the fact that, like, these were exciting times that he was working in. And exploitation can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And he spoke widely and he was addressing a lot of critics and dealing with a lot of supporters as well, you know, to put them along the right lines on this sort of thing. But I think the other thing about it, that's just the point I first wanted to make, really, which I think everybody knows anyway, is let's just remember the first sort of chapter of the Communist Manifesto. Marx says, you know, the history of all pre-existing societies is one of class exploitation, or some variation of that anyway, translated from German. So he isn't really saying that exploitation is innate to capitalism. I think what he was really saying is, well, actually, we've got a great opportunity now. We can actually work through this. This system can bring the productive forces up to the point where we can liberate humanity. And we're at that point now. You know, socialism is, it's there. The cake is already, you know, almost baked. And Marx has helped to bring us along to that. But I think it's important as well, as we all know, to keep him in his historical context. Thanks.
Thanks, Andy. Doogie, away you go.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, how does the law of value work in a socialist society? You might get some things that are, you know, in short shortage or whatever, you know, so they might be highly valued or whatever. And I know you talk about a surplus or whatever, but there are some things where there's limited numbers. I'm thinking maybe a concert, the number of people that can go and see a group or music or whatever. You know, I mean, how does the law of value work in a socialist society?
Okay, thanks, Adam.
Well, technically speaking, it won't work at all. The law of value won't apply in a socialist society. It only applies in societies where wealth is produced for sale. So, I mean, I think we should speak about value in socialism. You know, I think as Pat mentioned, you know, value is a social relation or a social concept, and it only has validity within certain types of society, which won't be social. But having said that, of course, there will be, you know, the problems that you mentioned of the allocation of resources and the allocation of workers. You know, that would be a problem. It'll be the problem of a social system of society, how to organise the production and distribution of wealth without buying and selling. How to organise this to satisfy people's needs. Well, on the specific thing about things that might be in short supply. Well, obviously, what you know, what can be distributed depends on what's available to be distributed. If in fact there isn't enough of something, some other method will have to be found out of sharing it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it could be equal sharing or something like that. But I mean, I think these would only be temporary things which were caused by some natural disaster, or maybe by somebody getting planning wrong. But I mean, they won't be permanent, you know, permanent features. But socialism will produce things for use, which will people be able to take according to their need. But having said that, there are a lot of people who call themselves Marxists or Marxian economists who do think that value will exist in socialism, and they, but by value, it comes back to what we were talking about before. They see it as the actual amount of labour that is spent on producing something, which in fact is the only thing that you'd be able to measure in a social society anyway. But because you know, in the end, it's only the market which sort of endorses or brings out value. If you haven't got a market, then this is not going to not going to happen. So I, as I say, I don't think we should use the word value or law of value in connection with a socialist system. So we should talk about something else, about how will we allocate resources and things like that. And I think in a socialist society, but if we do things, if we do calculations in kind, part of the calculations in kind are going to be how much labour you've got available, but not labour in general, but labour of different types. This happens now under capital anyway. When somebody's organising, some sort of building, somebody works out how many, what the materials are going to be and what types of skills are going to be. This happens now even under capitalism, but it's complicated by having to put a price on everything. So in socialism, these type of calculations in kind, including workers, will continue, but it won't be complicated by having to put a price on everything.
Yeah, I've thought that was the case. Thanks, Adam.
I think that's a really useful way of looking at the organisation of socialism as a huge quantity surveying exercise. Anybody else, anything that they want to contribute? Paula, go ahead, comrade.
Right, I'm going to just come across as being really ignorant here, I'm sorry, but I missed the beginning of the talk, but I'm not quite sure what the definition of value is. Are we talking about profit, or are we talking about, I think, what most people would define as being valuable, as being value, actually.
Can we get Adam's Mark's
Let me finish.
All right, go on.
So for example, let's take a woman who has children and stays at home and raises the children and looks after the worker and doesn't get paid for it. Let's look not just at care workers or teachers, but what about vets, right, who look after our domestic animals? What they're doing is of value, but the vet looking after our cats and our kittens and our dogs isn't actually helping the worker go out and produce profit. I'd like to hear more discussion about what we mean by, or what Marx means by value.
Sorry, Paul. I do apologise. I thought you'd finished making your point. That's why I interrupted you. I do apologise. Adam, will you go ahead, please?
Yeah, I mean, value can mean all sorts of things. What is something worth, and so on? Was it worth in money? What's it worth? But I think the distinction, which wasn't just made by Marx, it was made by people before him, is between usefulness or use value and economic value, which is basically exchange value or price. So, this has been the big argument. Some people say that price, reflects usefulness. Other people say it doesn't. Marx and people before him said it reflects how much labour has gone into producing it from start to finish. So, but use value. vets. There are plenty of activities which are, which are useful even under capitalism, but been to say that they don't produce value is you're saying is they don't produce anything economic. It's not a criticism. In fact, you could even say that the basic contradiction of capitalism is between use value and exchange value, because while things have to be useful, or are useful, they have to have a price under capitalism. And in fact, in one of Marx's later writings, he goes into the etymology of the words in German for value and worth, and traces them back to Old High German and Proto-German and so on. But, so you can have all sorts of discussions as to what the word value means. But the two ones employed in economics is use value and exchange value. And to come to your other point about women who stay at home and bring up the next generation of workers. Well, I think they're in the same sort of position as teachers and healthcare workers. I mean, they're also contributing towards the the creation of a working class. But I think in earlier days, the worker or the male worker was paid sufficient wages to maintain a wife and family. Whereas, I mean, that's changed now. A lot of women go out to work, and so the wage of the man doesn't include that element anymore. But it's once again capitalism distorting everything.
Do you want to come back, Cora?
No, that's okay. That's fine. Yeah, obviously, okay. I've got to go back and look at Marx and his definitions of use value and so on. But while I'm still got the microphone, could I just say to Richard, he really must stop referring to workers as he, because when Richard was talking, I was. Found myself getting quite agitated because, women are workers too. Okay, thank you.
I think we should use the word them, shouldn't we? Or they. Right. Comrade Carter, please.
This is something that we were talking about a couple of months ago to do with the strike of the railway workers, the drivers and RMT and ASLEF. And John pointed out that they are actually participating in the class struggle. And I wouldn't deny that, but I was thinking that while they're doing that, they have to also take part in all these awful negotiations that go on between the management who are operating for the capitalist class and for the actual workers. And their negotiations can take the part of giving way or appearing to give way when they get to this table that they seem to be so slow at reaching. And it seemed that with the advances of capitalism, with the technology that's now available, that the railway workers are having their case undermined by the fact that people don't need to use money in the same way as we all used to do. And as people in London know, it's almost a cashless society in some aspects. You have these Oyster cards when you're travelling on the railway and you don't use money. You're hardly able to use money. And that maybe not so in the rest of the country or in other parts of the country. So, of course, it's an uneven struggle that's going on between the workers and the management, but it's part of the very obvious, to us anyway, the very obvious class struggle. And I just wonder, because when I was in the trade union, when I was working in the library system, in a local government, there was always meetings going on between the management and between the trade union, between representatives, the shop stewards. about what we would do and what we wouldn't do and what we wanted and what we didn't want. But even during that short time that I was involved in that trade union activity, it did seem as if we were taking, trying to take one step forward, but being pushed two steps back. And because of the changes in the use in the library system, and people are not borrowing books in the same way, they're wanting to have computer lessons, which there's racks of them now in the libraries to have people using the computers and learning how to use the computers, and also borrowing DVDs and CDs and box sets of tapes. It's very much changed from how it used to be, very straightforward. And as I've said, it was like we were trying to take one step forward and going back two steps. Well, I've looked at the library system, the arrangement of the libraries that there are now in the area that I used to live in, and where there were once 12 libraries, there are now only 9. And one of those is a community library. It's run by the people in the area, not library workers. So what has happened there in that London borough seems to be an example of how the class struggle goes from one set of workers to another. And we have to be very nifty to keep on top of the game, because it's weighted against the working class. I think I'll stop there.
Hi. Thanks, Jenna. Right. Do you want to come in, Adam? Because I've got something to say on that. I think it's the same old story, isn't it? We've got technology that's been introduced, new technology that's been introduced, which is having a detrimental effect on workers' living standards, on the value of the wages, and so on and so forth. And this is going across all of these professions that were supposed to be professional. You know, you can see even, it's even beginning to affect lawyers, it's beginning to affect film producers, all these people that somehow or other didn't belong to the working class are now facing up to these issues that industrial workers have faced with since the inception of capital. Okay, thank you, Adam. Do you want to go? I beg your pardon.
It comes back to Marx's talk to these trade union leaders in 1865. I think most of them, in fact, in the building trade. I mean, you know, right at the end of Value, Price and Profit, he says, in 99 cases out of 100, what trade union action is reacting to something that's changed, something the employers want to do, and that in fact, it's trade union action is essentially, defensive in some circumstances. You know, if the market for the goods puts the workers in a favourable bargaining position, they can get something. But as you say, 99 out of 100, he says, it's defensive, and we all know it here how it ends. Instead of the conservative motto, fair day's work for a fair day's wages, they should raise the revolutionary watchword of abolition of the wages system. But if you look at the arguments being put forward, even by Lynch and the other militant people, they're all talking about, we want to be paid decent wages, we want a fair deal, and they're still essentially doing the same as the building trade workers unions were in 1865. I mean, that's what, if you like, trade unionism is trying to do. It's trying to ensure that workers get the best price they can for what they've got to sell, but it's running fast to stay still. It's defensive, and that's where we come in as socialists. This was Marx's point as well. In fact, the workers need to organise politically as well to take the means of production out of the hands of the owning class and put them in the hands of the community under democratic control. As I say, we're back to the first point that was made by Andy. As I say, it's not, well, we, we all know that, you know, the ending of value, price and profit is good.
Okay, thanks. I've just stuck my hand up because I want to put my two pennies in. I shouldn't have said that. It's interesting that value, price and profit has been brought up, because I don't know, are a lot of people in this meeting thinking, what the bloody hell is all, what's the point of all this, of understanding the Marx's theory of value? And what we need to remember is that capital, the work capital, has got a subtitle, The Critique of Political Economy. And what he's actually doing in his text is he's reviewing people like, not exclusively, Adam Smith and Ricardo. Adam Smith took a particular view, which is that free market capitalism, despite the fact that he'd not experienced any of it, the only thing that he could think about was the bloody pin factory. He ignored textiles, he ignored engineering and all that sort of stuff. I mean, in part because he just didn't have an experience of a mature capitalist society. But he put forward this idea that if capital develops in a normal way, then everything's going to be all fine and bonny for the workers. In actual fact, it was totally contradictory, because at certain times they say that, well, wages are going to go down as well, but everybody will be somehow happy because we're living in this capitalist society. Ricardo had a different approach. He didn't think that that things were necessarily going to be great for us. He foresaw capitalism as coming to a grinding halt. How seriously he took that that idea is another matter. But what Marx is doing when he's talking about the what Adam's doing is when he's talking about the labour theory of value is putting forward an alternative view that workers are not going to benefit in the capitalist society, because we're always going to be subject to the instability of the system. We're always going to be faced with advancing technology, which has got a tendency to depress our wages and so on and so forth. But it's also going to be what he mentioned before, which is this continual increasing lack of choice of the working class, this degradation of workers, whether it be in terms of the nature of the work or the amount of independence that they have in the work, the amount of decision making that they can make as well. So this understanding of the way that capital works is essential to combat the nonsensical idea that workers are ever going to be we're going to end up with cake and ale. We're not. But we need to have the theoretical underpinning to explain that to our fellow workers. So yeah, so all of you who don't know Marx, please come to our thing on the Education Committee. That's me.
Yeah. Sometimes we, or people, or even including us, we talk about Marx as a an economist, but he wasn't really an economist. Economists today are people that advise governments and companies. They formulate policies. The critic of political economy, the political economists, like you just said, Adam Smith and Ricardo, they had a particular program. They wanted to introduce free market capitalism in place of what was before, which was a market system which had restrictions caused by government interference and relics of feudalism. So Marx was analysing the capitalist system and was showing that as you said, it can never be made to work in the interests of the working class. He wasn't interested in suggesting policies which should be pursued under capitalism. But of course, there are lots of people who call themselves Marxists, even Marx economists who said, well, what is Marx's policy on banking? What is Marx's policy on, what's Marx's fiscal policy? What's his monetary policy? Well, he didn't have any. He wasn't advocating that. He wasn't an economist in that sense. He was somebody that was analysing capitalism to show it that it could only work in the, to show how it worked and how it couldn't work in the interests of workers. He wasn't interested in making things better under capitalism or better for capitalism. Having said that, he was interested in workers trying to improve their condition within capitalism to the extent that they could. But he wasn't proposing any policy for governments to pursue.
I think this meeting may have run its natural course. It is 9 o'clock. I've got the smell of the beer mat of a drip mat wafting my way. So if anybody, unless anybody wants to come in and say something quickly, do you want to? Or have you summed up with that, Adam? Do you think?
No, I don't think so. It's a useful discussion on the theory of value and Marx and economics.
Okay. Well, thank. In that case, I'll call the meeting to a close. Thank you very much for all coming. Thank you, Adam, for your efforts. And we'll see you all soon. Thank you. Yeah, see you.